ability to wander far and free. It steals away for a while from the prison in which it is confined, and has its strength renewed in the world above. When craftsmen engaged on some intricate piece of work, which imposes a tiring strain on the eyes, have to work by an inadequate and undependable light, they go out into the open air and treat their eyes to the free sunshine, in some open space or other dedicated to public recreation. In the same way the soul, shut away in this dim and dismal dwelling, as often as it can, makes for the open and finds its relaxation in contemplating the natural universe. The wise man and devotee of philosophy is, needless to say, inseparable from his body, and yet he is detached from it, so far as the best part of his personality is concerned, directing his thoughts towards things far above. He looks on this present life of his, much like the man who has signed on as a soldier, as the term he has to serve out. And he is so made that he neither loves life nor hates it. He endures the lot of mortality, even though he knows there is a finer one in store for him. Are you telling me not to investigate the natural world? Are you trying to bar me from the whole of it and restrict me to a part of it? Am I not to inquire how everything in the universe began, who gave things form, who separated them out, when they were all plunged together in a single great conglomeration of inert matter? Am I not to inquire into the identity of the artist who created that universe, or the process by which this huge mass became subject to law and order, or the nature of the one who collected the things that were scattered apart, sorted apart the things that were commingled, and when all things lay in formless chaos, allotted them their individual shapes? Or the source of the light, is it fire, or is it something brighter, that is shed on us in such abundance? Am I supposed not to inquire into this sort of thing? Am I not to know where I am descended from, whether I am to see this world only once, or be born into it again, time after time, what my destination is to be after I stay here, what abode will await my soul on its release from the terms of its serfdom on earth? Are you forbidding me to associate with heaven, in other words, ordering me to go through life with my eyes bent on the ground? I am too great, was born to too great a destiny to be my body's slave. So far as I am concerned, that body is nothing more or less than a fetter on my freedom. I place it squarely in the path of fortune, letting her expend her onslaught on it, not allowing any blow to get through it to my actual self. For that body is all that is vulnerable about me. Within this dwelling, so liable to injury, there lives a spirit that is free. Never shall that flesh compel me to feel fear. Never shall it drive me to any pretense unworthy of a good man. Never shall I tell a lie out of consideration for this petty body. I shall dissolve our partnership when this seems the proper course. And even now, while we are bound one to the other, the partnership will not be on equal terms. The soul will assume undivided authority. Refusal to be influenced by one's body assures one's freedom. And to this freedom, to get back to the subject, even the kind of inquiries we were talking about just now have a considerable contribution to make. We know that everything in the universe is composed of matter and of God. God, encompassed within them, controls them all, they following his leadership and guidance. Greater power and greater value reside in that which creates, in this case God, than in the matter on which God works. Well, the place which in this universe is occupied by God is in man, the place of the spirit. What matter is in the universe, the body, is in us. Let the worse then serve the better. Let us meet with bravery, whatever may befall us. Let us never feel a shudder at the thought of being wounded, or of being made a prisoner, or of poverty or persecution. What is death? Either a transition or an end. I am not afraid of coming to an end, this being the same as never having begun, nor a transition, for I shall never be in confinement quite so cramped anywhere else as I am here. Letter number 77. Today we saw some boats from Alexandria, the ones they call the mail packets, come into view all of a sudden. They were the ones which are normally sent ahead to announce the coming of the fleet that will arrive behind them. The sight of them is always a welcome one to the companions. The whole of Puteoli crowded onto the wharves, all picking out the Alexandrian vessels from an immense crowd of other shipping, by the actual trim of their sails, these boats being the only vessels allowed to keep their topsails spread. Out at sea, all ships carry these sails, for nothing makes quite the same contribution to speed as the upper canvas, the area from which a boat derives the greatest part of its propulsion. That is why, whenever the wind stiffens and becomes unduly strong, sail is shortened, the wind having less force lower down. On entering the channel between Capri and the headland from which, upon the storm-swept summit, Pallas keeps a high lookout, regulations require all other vessels to confine themselves to carrying a mainsail, and the topsail is accordingly conspicuous on the Alexandrian boats. While everyone around me was hurrying thus from all directions to the waterfront, I found a great deal of pleasure in refusing to bestir myself. Although there would be letters for me from my people over there, I was in no hurry to know what reports they might be carrying or what might be the state of my financial interests there. For a long time now, I have not been concerned about any profit or loss. This particular pleasure was one that I ought to have been experiencing, even if I were not an old man. But being old, in fact, made it all the greater, for it meant that however little money I might have, I should still have more left to cover the journey than distance left to be covered, especially as the journey on which we have all set out is one which does not have to be travelled to the very end. An ordinary journey will be incomplete if you come to a stop in the middle of it, or anywhere short of your destination, but life is never incomplete if it is an honourable one. At whatever point you leave life, if you leave it in the right way, it is a whole. And there are many occasions on which a man should leave life not only bravely, but for reasons which are not as pressing as they might be, the reasons which restrain us being not so pressing either. Tullius Marcellinus, whom you knew very well, a man old before his years, who found tranquillity early in life, began to meditate suicide, after he had gone down with a disease which was not an incurable one, but at the same time was a protracted, troublesome one, importunate in its demands. He called together a large number of his friends, and each one offered him advice. This consisted either of urgings from the timid among them, that he should just take whichever course he himself felt urged to take, or of whatever counsel flattering admirers thought would be the most likely to gratify someone meditating suicide, until a stoic friend of mine, an outstanding personality, for whom I could find no more fitting compliment than that of calling him a man of fighting courage, gave what I thought was the most inspiring advice, and this was how he began. "My dear Marcellinus," he said, "you mustn't let this worry you, as if you were having to make a great decision. There's nothing so very great about living. All your slaves and all the animals do it. What is, however, a great thing, is to die in a manner which is honourable, enlightened, and courageous. Think how long now you've been doing the same as them. Food, sleep, sex, the never-ending cycle. The desire for death can be experienced not merely by the enlightened or the brave or the unhappy, but even by the squeamish." Well, Marcellinus wanted no urging, only a helper. His slaves refused to obey him in this, whereupon our stoic talked away their fears, letting them know that the household staff could only be in danger if there had been any room for doubt as to whether their master's death had been a voluntary one. "Besides," he told them, "it was just as bad to let other people see you ordering your master not to kill himself as actually to kill him." He then suggested to Marcellinus himself that it would not be an unkind gesture if, in the same way as at the end of a dinner, the leftovers are divided among the attendants. Something were offered at the end of his life to those who had served throughout it. Marcellinus had a generous and good-natured disposition, which was no less evident when it meant personal expense, and he distributed accordingly little sums of money among his slaves, who were now in tears, and went out of his way to comfort them all. He did not need to resort to a weapon or to shedding blood. After going without food for 3 days, he had a steam tent put up, in his own bedroom. A bath was brought in which he lay for a long time, and as fresh supplies of hot water were continually poured in, he passed almost imperceptibly away. not without, as he commented more than once, a kind of pleasurable sensation, one that is apt to be produced by the gentle fading out of which those of us who have ever fainted will have some experience. I have digressed, but you will not have minded hearing this story, since you will gather from it that your friend's departure was not a difficult or unhappy one. Although his death was self-inflicted, the manner of his passing was supremely relaxed, a mere gliding out of life. Yet the story is not without its practical value for the future, for frequently enough necessity demands just such examples. The times are frequent enough when we cannot reconcile ourselves to dying, or to knowing that we ought to die. No one is so ignorant as not to know that some day he must die. Nevertheless, when death draws near, he turns wailing and trembling, looking for a way out. Wouldn't you think a man a prize fool if he burst into tears because he didn't live 1,000 years ago? A man is as much a fool for shedding tears because he isn't going to be alive 1,000 years from now. There's no difference between the one and the other. You didn't exist and you won't exist. You've no concern with either period. This is the moment you've been pitched into. Supposing you were to make it longer, how long would you make it? What's the point of tears? What's the point of prayers? You're only wasting your breath. So give up hoping that your prayers can bring some change in the decisions of the gods. Those decisions are fixed and permanent, part of the mighty and eternal train of destiny. You will go the way that all things go. What is strange about that? That is the law to which you were born. It was the lot of your father, your mother, your ancestors, and of all who came before you, as it will be of all who come after you. There is no means of altering the irresistible succession of events which carries all things along in its binding grip. Think of the multitudes of people doomed to die that will be following you, that will be keeping you company. I imagine you'd be braver about it if thousands upon thousands were dying with you. The fact is that men, as well as other creatures, are breathing their last in one way or another in just such numbers at the very instant when you are unable to make your mind up about death. You weren't thinking, surely, that you wouldn't yourself one day arrive at the destination towards which you've been heading from the beginning? Every journey has its end. Here, I imagine, you'll be expecting me to tell you the stories of examples set by heroic men. Well, I'll tell you about ones which children have set. History relates the story of the famous Spartan, a mere boy, who, when he was taken prisoner, kept shouting in his native Doric, "I shall not be a slave." He was as good as his word. The first time he was ordered to perform a slave's task, some humiliating household job, his actual orders were to fetch a disgusting chamber pot, he dashed his head against a wall and cracked his skull open. Freedom is as near as that. Is anyone really still a slave? Would you not rather your own son died like that than lived by reason of spinelessness to an advanced age? Why be perturbed then about death when even a child can meet it bravely? Suppose you refuse to follow him. You will just be dragged after him. Assume the authority which at present lies with others. Surely you can adopt the spirited attitude of that boy and say, "No slave am I." At present, you unhappy creature, slave you are. Slave to your fellow men, slave to circumstance, and slave to life. For life itself is slavery, if the courage to die be absent. Have you anything that might induce you to wait? You have exhausted the very pleasures that make you hesitate and hold you back. Not one of them has any novelty for you. Not one of them now fails to bore you out of sheer excess. You know what wine or honey wine tastes like. It makes no difference whether 100 or 1,000 flagons go through your bladder. All you are is a strainer. You are perfectly familiar with the taste of oysters or mullet. Your luxurious way of life has kept back not a single fresh experience for you to try in coming years, and yet these are the things from which you are reluctant to be torn away. What else is there which you would be sorry to be deprived of? Friends? Do you know how to be a friend? Your country? Do you really value her so highly that you would put off your dinner for her? The sunlight? If you could, you would put out that light, for what have you ever done that deserved a place in it? Confess it, It is no attachment to the world of politics or business, or even the world of nature, that makes you put off dying. The delicatessens, in which there is nothing you have left untried, are what you are reluctant to leave. You are scared of death. But how magnificently heedless of it you are, while you are dealing with a dish of choice mushrooms. You want to live. But do you know how to live? You are scared of dying. And tell me, is the kind of life you lead really any different from being dead? Caligula was once passing a column of captives on the Latin road, when one of them, with a hoary old beard reaching down to his breast, begged to be put to death. "So," replied Caligula, "you are alive, then, as you are? That is the answer to give to people to whom death would actually come as a release. You are scared of dying? So you are alive, then, as you are? Someone, though, will say, 'But I want to live because of all the worthy activities I'm engaged in. I'm performing life's duties conscientiously and energetically, and I'm reluctant to leave them undone.' Come now, surely you know that dying is also one of life's duties? You're leaving no duty undone, for there's no fixed number of duties laid down which you're supposed to complete. Every life, without exception, is a short one. Look at in relation to the universe, even the lives of Nestor and Satyr were short. In Satyr, who ordered that her epitaph should record that she had lived to the age of 99, you have an example of someone actually boasting of a prolonged old age. Had it so happened that she had lasted out the 100th year, everybody, surely, would have found her quite insufferable. As it is with a play, so it is with life. What matters is not how long the acting lasts, but how good it is. It is not important at what point you stop. Stop whatever you will. Only make sure that you round it off with a good ending." Letter number 78. "I am all the more sorry to hear of the trouble you were having with constant catarrh, and the spells of feverishness which go with it, when it becomes protracted to the point of being chronic, because this kind of ill health is something I have experienced myself. In its early stages, I refused to let it bother me, being still young enough then to adopt a defiant attitude to sickness and put up with hardships, but eventually I succumbed to it altogether. Reduced to a state of complete emaciation, I had arrived at a point where the catarrhal discharges were virtually carrying me away with them altogether. On many an occasion I felt an urge to cut my life short there and then, and was only held back by the thought of my father, who had been the kindest of fathers to me, and was then in his old age. Having in mind not how bravely I was capable of dying, but how far from bravely he was capable of bearing the loss, I commanded myself to live. There are times when even to live is an act of bravery. Let me tell you the things that provided me with consolation in those days, telling you, to begin with, that the thoughts which brought me this peace of mind had all the effect of medical treatment. Comforting thoughts, provided they are not of a discreditable kind, contribute to a person's cure. Anything which raises his spirits benefits him physically as well. It was my Stoic studies that really saved me. For the fact that I was able to leave my bed and was restored to health, I give the credit to philosophy. I owe her, and it is the least of my obligations to her, my life. But my friends also made a considerable contribution to my return to health. I found a great deal of relief in their cheering remarks, in the hours they spent at my bedside, and in their conversations with me. There is nothing, my good Lucilius, quite like the devotion of one's friends for supporting one in illness and restoring one to health, or for dispelling one's anticipation and dread of death. I even came to feel that I could not really die when these were the people I would leave surviving me, or perhaps I should say I came to think I would continue to live because of them, if not among them. For it seemed to me that in death I would not be passing away, but passing on my spirit to them. These things gave me the willingness to help my own recovery and to endure all the pain. It is quite pathetic, after all, if one has put the will to die behind one, to be without the will to live. There, then, are your remedies. The doctor will be telling you how much walking you should do, how much exercise you should take. He will be telling you not to overdo the inactivity, as is the tendency with invalids, and recommending reading aloud to exercise the breathing, its passages and reservoir being the areas affected. He will recommend that you take a trip by sea, and derive some stimulation for the internal organs from the gentle motion of the boat. He will prescribe a diet for you, and tell you when to make use of wine as restorative, and when to give it up in case it starts you coughing, or aggravates your cough. My own advice to you, and not only in the present illness, but in your whole life as well, is this. Refuse to let the thought of death bother you. Nothing is grim when we have escaped that fear. There are three upsetting things about any illness: the fear of dying, the physical suffering, and the interruption of our pleasures. I've said enough about the first, but will just say this, that the fear is due to the facts of nature, not of illness. Illness has actually given many people a new lease of life. The experience of being near to death has been their preservation. You will die not because you are sick, but because you are alive. That end still awaits you when you have been cured. In getting well again, you may be escaping some ill health, but not death. And now let us go back and deal with the disadvantage which really does belong to illness, the fact that it involves considerable physical torments. These are made bearable by their intermittency, for when pain is at its most severe, the very intensity finds means of ending it. Nobody can be in acute pain and feel it for long. Nature, in her unlimited kindness to us, has so arranged things as to make pain either bearable or brief. The severest pains have their seat in the most attenuated parts of the body. Any area of slight dimensions, like a tendon or a joint, causes excruciating agony when trouble arises within its small confines. But these parts of our anatomy go numb very quickly, the pain itself giving rise to a loss of all sensation of pain. Either because the life force is impaired by being held up in its natural circulation, and so loses its active power, the power which enables it to give us warning of pain, or because the diseased secretions, no longer able to drain away, become self-obliterated, and deprive the areas they have congested of sensation. Thus, gout in the feet or the hands, or any pain in the vertebrae or tendons, has intermittent lulls when it has dulled the area it is torturing. These are all cases in which the distress is caused by the initial twinges, and the violence of the pain disappears as time goes on, the suffering ending in a state of insensibility. The reason why pain in an eye or ear or a tooth is exceptionally severe is the fact that it develops in a limited area, and indeed this applies just as much to pains in the head. Nevertheless, if its intensity goes beyond a certain point, it is turned into a state of dazed stupefaction. So there is the comforting thing about extremities of pain. If you feel it too much, you are bound to stop feeling it. What in fact makes people who are morally unenlightened upset by the experience of physical distress is the failure to acquire the habit of contentment with the spirit. They have instead been preoccupied by the body. That is why a man of noble and enlightened character separates body from spirit, and has just as much to do with the former, the frail and complaining part of our nature, as is necessary and no more, and a lot to do with the better, the divine element. But it's hard having to do without pleasures we're used to, having to give up food and go thirsty as well as hungry. Tiresome it is in the first stages of abstinence. Later, as the organs of appetite decline in strength with exhaustion, the cravings die down. Thereafter the stomach becomes fussy, unable to stand things it could never have enough of before. The desires themselves die away, and there is nothing harsh about having to do without things for which you have ceased to have any craving. Another point is that every pain leaves off altogether, or at least falls off in intensity from time to time. Moreover, one can guard against its arrival, and employ drugs to forestall it, just as it is coming on. For every pain, or at least every pain with a habit of regular recurrence, gives one advance warning of its coming. In illness, the suffering is always bearable so long as you refuse to be affected by the ultimate threat. So do not go out of your way to make your troubles any more tiresome than they are, and burden yourself with fretting. Provided that one's thinking has not been adding anything to it, pain is a trivial sort of thing. If, by contrast, you start giving yourself encouragement, saying to yourself, "It's nothing, or nothing much anyway, let's stick it out, it'll be over presently," then in thinking it a trivial matter, you will be ensuring that it actually is. Everything hangs on one's thinking. The love of power or money or luxurious living are not the only things which are guided by popular thinking. We take our cue from people's thinking, even in the way we feel pain. A man is as unhappy as he has convinced himself he is. And complaining away about one's sufferings after they are over, you know the kind of language, "No one has ever been in such a bad state. The torments and hardships I endured. No one thought I would recover. The number of times I was given up for lost by the family. The number of times I was despaired of by the doctors. A man on the rack isn't torn with pain the way I was." Is something I think should be banned. Even if all this is true, it is past history. What's the good of dragging up sufferings which are over? Of being unhappy now, just because you were then. What is more, doesn't everyone add a good deal to his tale of hardships, and deceive himself as well in the matter? Besides, there is a pleasure in having succeeded in enduring something, the actual enduring of which was very far from pleasant. And when some trouble or other comes to an end, the natural thing is to be glad. There are two things, then, the recollecting of trouble in the past, as well as the fear of troubles to come, that I have to root out. The first is no longer any concern to me, and the second has yet to be so. And when a man is in the grip of difficulties, he should say, "There may be pleasure in the memory of even these events one day." He should put his whole heart into the fight against them. If he gives way before them, he will lose the battle. If he exerts himself against them, he will win. What in fact most people do is pull down on their own heads what they should be holding up against. When something is in imminent danger of falling on you, the pressure of it bearing heavily on you, it will only move after you and become an even greater weight to support if you back away from it. If instead you stand your ground, willing yourself to resist, it will be forced back. Look at the amount of punishment that boxers and wrestlers take to the face and the body generally. They will put up nonetheless with any suffering in their desire for fame, and will undergo it all not merely in the course of fighting, but in preparing for their fights as well. Their training in itself constitutes suffering. Let us, too, overcome all things, with our reward consisting not in any wreath or garland, not in trumpet calls for silence, for the ceremonial proclamation of our name, but in moral worth, in strength of spirit, in a peace that is won for ever, once in any contest fortune has been utterly defeated. "I'm suffering severe pain," you may say. Well, does it stop you suffering it, if you endure it in a womanish fashion? In the same way as the enemy can do far more damage to your army if it is in full retreat, every trouble that may come our way presses harder on the one who has turned tail and is giving ground. "But it's really severe." Well, is courage only meant to enable us to bear up under what is not severe? Would you rather have an illness that's long, drawn out, or one that's short and quick? If it's a long one, it will have the odd interval, giving one opportunity for rallying, granting one a good deal of time free of it, having a necessity to pause in order to build up again. An illness that's swift and short will have one of two results, either oneself or it will be snuffed out. And what difference does it make whether I or it disappears? Either way, there's an end to the pain. Another thing which will help is to turn your mind to other thoughts and that way get away from your suffering. Call to mind things which you have done that have been upright or courageous. Run over in your mind the finest parts that you have played, and cast your memory over the things you have most admired. This is a time for recollecting all those individuals of exceptional courage who have triumphed over pain. The man who steadily went on reading a book while he was having varicose veins cut out. The man who never stopped smiling under torture, albeit that this angered his tormentors into trying on him every instrument of cruelty they had. If pain has been conquered by a smile, will it not be conquered by reason? And here you may mention anything you care to name. Catarrh, a fit of uninterrupted coughing so violent that it brings up parts of the internal organs. Having one's very entrails seared by a fever. Thirst, having limbs wrenched in different directions with dislocation of the joints, or worse than these, being stretched on the rack or burnt alive, or subjected to the red-hot plates and instruments designed to reopen and deepen swelling wounds. There have been men who have undergone these experiences and never uttered a groan. He needs more. He hasn't asked for mercy. He needs more. He still hasn't answered. He needs more. He has actually smiled, and not a forced smile either. Surely pain is something you will want to smile at after this. But my illness has taken me away from my duties and won't allow me to achieve anything. Well, it is your body, not your mind as well, that is in the grip of ill health. Hence it may slow the feet of a runner and make the hands of a smith or cobbler less efficient. But if your mind is by habit of an active turn, you may still give instruction and advice. Listen and learn, inquire and remember. Besides, if you meet sickness in a sensible manner, do you really think you are achieving nothing? You will be demonstrating that even if one cannot always beat it, one can always bear an illness. There is room for heroism, I assure you, in bed as anywhere else. War and the battlefront are not the only spheres in which proof is to be had of a spirited and fearless character. A person's bravery is no less evident under the bedclothes. There is something it lies open to you to achieve, and that is making the fight with illness a good one. If its threats or importunities leave you quite unmoved, you are setting others a signal example. How much scope there would be for renown if, whenever we were sick, we had an audience of spectators. Be your own spectator, anyway, your own applauding audience. Pleasures, moreover, are of two kinds. The physical pleasures are the ones which illness interferes with, though it does not do away with them altogether. Indeed, if you take a true view of the matter, they are actually sharpened by illness. A man deriving greater pleasure from drinking something when he is thirsty and finding food all the more welcome through being hungry, anything set before one, after one has had to fast, being greeted with a heightened appetite. But no doctor can refuse his patient those other greater and surer pleasures, the pleasures of the mind and spirit. Anyone who follows these and genuinely knows them pays no attention whatever to all the enticements of the senses. How very unfortunate he is, people say, to be sick like that. Why? Because he isn't melting snow in his wine? Because he isn't breaking ice into a bumper goblet to keep the drink he has mixed in it chilled? Because leucrine oysters aren't being opened before him at his table? Because there isn't any bustling of cooks about the dining room, bringing in not just the viands themselves, but the actual cooking apparatus along with them? For this is the latest innovation in luxurious living, having the kitchen accompany the dinner end to the table, so as to prevent any of the food losing its heat, and avoid anything being at a temperature insufficiently scalding for palates which are nowadays like leather. How very unfortunate he is to be sick, they say. In fact, he'll be eating just as much as he'll digest. There won't be a whole boar lying somewhere where people can see it, conveying the impression that it has been banished from the table as being too cheap and ordinary a piece of meat to be on it, nor will he have his trolley piled high with, now that people think it not quite nice to see the whole bird, carved breast of fowl. And what's so bad about your being deprived of that? You may be eating like a sick man, but you'll at last be eating in the way a healthy man should. But given one thing, we shall find it easy to put up with the potions and warm drinks and all the rest of it, all the things that seem unbearable to people who have become spoilt, who have become soft through a life of luxury, ailing more in the mind than they ever are in the body. The one requirement is that we cease to dread death. And so we shall, as soon as we have learnt to distinguish the good things and the bad things in this world. Then and only shall we stop being weary of living, as well as scared of dying. For a life spent viewing all the variety, the majesty, the sublimity in things around us, can never succumb to ennui. The feeling that one is tired of being, of existing, is usually the result of an idle and inactive leisure. Truth will never pall on someone who explores the world of nature, wearied as a person will be by the spurious things. Moreover, even if death is on the way with a summons for him, though it come all too early, though it cut him off in the prime of life, he has experienced every reward that the very longest life can offer, having gained extensive knowledge of the world we live in, having learnt that time adds nothing to the finer things in life. Whereas any life must needs seem short to people who measure it in terms of pleasures, which through their empty nature are incapable of completeness. Let these reflections promote your recovery, and meanwhile do find time for our correspondence. Time will bring us together again one of these days, and when, as it will, the reunion comes, however short it may last, knowing how to make the most of it will turn it into a long one. As Posidonius said, in a single day there lies open to men of learning more than there ever does to the unenlightened in the longest of lifetimes. In the meantime, cling tooth and nail to the following rule, not to give in to adversity, never to trust prosperity, and always take full note of fortune's habit of behaving just as she pleases, treating her as if she were actually going to do everything it is in her power to do. Whatever you have been expecting for some time comes as less of a shock. Letter number 83. You demand an account of my days, generally as well as individually. You think well of me if you suppose that there is nothing in them for me to hide. And we should indeed live as if we were in public view, and think, too, as if someone could peer into the inmost recesses of our hearts, which someone can. For what is to be gained if something is concealed from man, when nothing is barred from God? He is present in our minds, in attendance in the midst of our thoughts. Although by attendance I do not mean to suggest that he is not at times absent from our thoughts. I shall do as you say, then, and gladly give you a record of what I do and in what order. I shall put myself under observation straight away, and undertake a review of my day, a course which is of the utmost benefit. What really ruins our characters is the fact that none of us looks back over his life. We think about what we are going to do, and only rarely of that, and fail to think about what we have done. Yet any plans for the future are dependent on the past. Today has been unbroken. No one has robbed me of any part of it. It has been wholly divided between my bed and my reading. A very small part of it has been given over to physical exercise. And on this account I am grateful for old age, for the exercise costs me little trouble. I only have to stir and I am weary, and that, after all, is the end of exercise, even for the strongest. Interested in having my trainers? One's enough for me. Farius, a likeable young fellow, as you know, but he's due for a change. I'm looking now for someone rather more youthful. He in fact declares that we're both at the same climacteric, since we're both losing our teeth, but I've reached the stage where I can only keep up with him with difficulty when we're out for a run, and before many days are out, I won't be able to keep up with him at all. See what daily exercise does for one. When two people are going in opposite directions, there's soon a big distance between them. He's coming up at the same time as I'm going downwards, and you know how much quicker travel is in the second of these directions. But I'm wrong. The age I'm at isn't one that is going downwards. It's one that's in headlong descent. However, if you'd like to hear how today's race ended, well, we've made it a tie, something that doesn't often happen with runners. After this, more a spell of exhaustion than of exercise, I had a cold plunge. Cold with me, meaning just short of warm. Here I am, once celebrated as a devotee of cold baths, regularly paying my respects to the canal on the 1st of January, and jumping into the maiden pool in just the same way as I read, wrote, and spoke some sentence or other every new year, in order to ensure good luck in the coming year. And now I've shifted my scene of operation, first to the Tiber, then to my own pool here, which even when I'm feeling my heartiest and don't cheat, has had the chill taken off it by the sun. It's a short step to a hot bath. The next thing is breakfast, which consists of some dry bread. No table laid, and no need to wash the hands after such a meal. I then have the briefest of naps. You know this habit of mine, of dropping off for a moment or two, just slipping off the harness, as you might say. I find it enough to have simply stopped being awake. Sometimes I know I've been asleep, sometimes merely guess I have been. Zeno was a very great man, as well as the founder of our Stoic school, a school with an unequalled record for courageous and saintly living. Well, listen to the way in which, desiring to deter us from drunkenness, he deduces the principle that the good man won't get drunk. No person who is drunk, he says, is entrusted with a secret. A good man is entrusted with a secret, therefore the good man will not get drunk. Watch how ridiculous he's made to look when we count up with a single syllogism on the same pattern. Of the many we could advance, it's sufficient to instance one. No person who is asleep is entrusted with a secret. The good man is entrusted with a secret, therefore the good man does not go to sleep. Now, just let each of us name for himself the people he knows can be trusted with a secret, though they can't be trusted with a bottle. I'll give all the same one solitary example myself, just to prevent its being lost to human memory. Life needs a stock of noteworthy examples, nor need we always go running to antiquity for them. Lucius Piso was drunk from the very moment of his appointment as warden of the city of Rome. He regularly spent most of the night wining and dining in company, and slept from then until around midday, noon to him being early morning. He nevertheless discharged his duties, which embraced the general welfare of the whole city, with the utmost efficiency. The late Emperor Augustus, as well as Tiberius, entrusted him with secret orders, the former on appointing him governor of Thrace, the conquest of which he completed, the latter when he left Rome for Campania, leaving behind him in the capital many objects of distrust and hostility. I imagine it was because Piso's drunken habits had been such a success, so far as he was concerned, that Tiberius later appointed Cossus to be prefect of the city. This man, otherwise dignified and self-controlled, steeped himself in liquor, soaking it up to such an extent that on one occasion in the Senate, having come there straight from a party, he succumbed to a slumber from which nothing could rouse him and had to be carried out. Yet this did not stop Tiberius writing in his own hand a number of letters to Cossus, the contents of which he did not consider suitable for communication even to his ministers, and Cossus never let slip a single secret, whether private or official. If you want to arrive at the conclusion that the good man ought not to get drunk, why set about it with syllogisms? Tell people how disgusting it is for a man to pump more into himself than he can hold, and not to know the capacity of his own stomach. Tell them of all the things men do that they would blush at sober, and that drunkenness is nothing but a state of self-induced insanity. For imagine the drunken man's behaviour extended over several days. Would you hesitate to think him out of his mind? As it is, the difference is simply one of duration, not of degree. Point to the example of Alexander of Macedon, stabbing his dearest and truest friend Clitus at a banquet, and wanting to die, as indeed he should have done, when he realized the enormity of what he had done. Drunkenness inflames and lays bare every vice, removing the reserve that acts as a check on impulses to wrong behavior. For people abstain from forbidden things far more often through feelings of inhibition when it comes to doing what is wrong, than through any will to good. Add to this the drunkard's ignorance of his situation, his indistinct, uncertain speech, his inability to walk straight, his unsteady eye and swimming head, with his very home in a state of motion, as if the whole house had been set spinning by some cyclone, and the tortures in his stomach as the wine ferments. Where is the glory in mere capacity? When the victory rests with you, when all the company lie prostrate around you, slumbering or vomiting, declining all your calls for another toast, when you find yourself the only person at the party still on your feet, when your mighty prowess has enabled you to beat all comers, and no one has proved able to match your intake, a barrel is none the less enough to beat you. What else was it but drinking to excess, together with a passion for Cleopatra, itself as potent as drink, that ruined that great and gifted man, Mark Antony, dragging him down into foreign ways of living and un-Roman vices? This it was that made him an enemy of the state. This is what made him no match for his enemies. It was this that made him cruel, having the heads of his country's leading men brought in to him at the dinner table, identifying the hands and features of liquidated opponents in the course of banquets marked by sumptuous magnificence and regal pomp, still thirsting for blood when filled to the full with wine. Explain, then, why the good man should avoid getting drunk, using facts, not words, to show its ugliness and offensiveness. Prove, and an easy task it is, that so-called pleasures, when they go beyond a certain limit, are but punishments. Letter number 86. Here I am, staying at the country house which once belonged to Scipio of Africa himself. I'm writing after paying my respects to his departed spirit, as well as to an altar, which I rather think may be the actual tomb of that great soldier. His soul will have gone to heaven, returned in fact to the place from which it came. What convinces me of this is not the size of the armies he commanded, for Cambyses equally had such armies, and Cambyses was merely a madman who turned his madness to good account, but his quite exceptional self-restraint and sense of duty. This is something in him which I find even more deserving of admiration of the time when he finally left his country than during the time when he was fighting for her. Was Scipio to stay in Rome, or was Rome to stay a free democracy? That was then the choice. What did Scipio say? I have no wish, he said, to have the effect of weakening in the least degree our laws or institutions. All Roman citizens must be equal before the law. I ask my country, then, to make the most of what I have done for her, but without me. If she owes it to me that she is today a free country, let me also prove that she is free. If my stature has grown too great for her best interests, then out I go. Am I not justified in admiring that nobility of character, which led him to retire, to go into voluntary exile, to relieve the state of an embarrassing burden? Events had come to the point where either Scipio or democracy was going to suffer at the other's hands. Neither of these two things could justly be permitted to happen. So he gave way to her constitution, and proposing that the nation should be no less indebted to him for his absence from the scene than for Hannibal's, he went off into retirement at Liternum. I've seen the house, which is built of squared stone blocks, the wall surrounding the park, and the towers built out on both sides of the house for purposes of defence. The well, concealed among the greenery and outbuildings, with sufficient water to provide for the needs of a whole army, and the tiny little bath, situated after the old-fashioned custom, in an ill-lit corner, our ancestors believing that the only place where one could properly have a hot bath was in the dark. It was this which started in my mind reflections that occasioned me a good deal of enjoyment, as I compared Scipio's way of life and our own. In this corner, the famous Terror of Carthage, to whom Rome owes it that she has only once in her history been captured, used to wash a body weary from work on the farm. For he kept himself fit through toil, cultivating his fields by his own labour, as was the regular way in the old days. And this was the ceiling, dingy in the extreme, under which he stood, and this the equally undistinguished paving that carried his weight. Who is there who could bear to have a bath in such surroundings nowadays? We think ourselves poorly off, living like paupers, if the walls are not ablaze with large and costly circular mirrors, if our Alexandrian marbles are not decorated with panels of Numidian marble, if the whole of their surface has not been given a decorative overlay of elaborate patterns, having all the variety of fresco murals, unless the ceiling cannot be seen for glass, unless the pools into which we lower bodies with all the strength drained out of them by lengthy periods in the sweating room are edged with Thasian marble, which was once the rarest of sights, even in a temple, unless the water pours from silver taps. And so far, we have only been talking about the ordinary fellows' plumbing. What about the bathhouses of certain former slaves? Look at their arrays of statues. They're assemblies of columns that do not support a thing, but are put up purely for ornament, just for the sake of spending money. Look at the cascades of water splashing noisily down from one level to the next. We have actually come to such a pitch of choosiness that we object to walking on anything other than precious stones. In this bathroom of Scipio's, there are tiny chinks, you could hardly call them windows, pierced in the masonry of the wall, in such a way as to let in light without in any way weakening its defensive character. Nowadays, moth-hole is the way some people speak of a bathroom, unless it has been designed to catch the sun through enormous windows all day long, unless a person can acquire a tan at the same time as he is having a bath, unless he has views from the bath over countryside and sea. The result is that bathhouses, which drew admiring crowds when they were first opened, are actually dismissed as antiquated as soon as extravagance has hit on any novelty calculated to put its own best previous efforts in the shade. There was a time when bathhouses were few and far between, and never in the least luxuriously appointed. And why should they have been, considering that they were designed for use, not for diversion, and that admission only cost you a copper? There were no showers in those days, and the water did not come in a continuous gush, as if from a hot spring. People did not think it mattered then how clear the water was in which they were going to get rid of the dirt. Heavens, what a pleasure it is to go into one of those half-lit bathhouses with their ordinary plastered ceilings, where you knew that Cato himself as aedile, or Fabius Maximus, or one of the Cornelii, regulated the warmth of your water with his own hand. For however high their rank, it was one of the duties of the aediles to enter all such premises as were open to the public, and enforce standards of cleanliness and a healthy sort of temperature, sufficient for practical purposes, not the kind of heat which has recently come into fashion, more like that of a furnace, so much so, indeed, that a slave convicted on a criminal charge might well be sentenced to be bathed alive. There doesn't seem to me to be any difference now between your baths warm and your baths boiling. How primitive! Such is some people's verdict these days on Scipio, because he did not have extensive areas of glass to let the daylight into the perspiring room, because it was not a habit with him to stew in strong sunlight, letting the time go by until he was perfectly cooked in his own bathroom. What a sorry wretch of a man! He didn't know how to live. He'd take his bath in water that was never filtered, and often cloudy, practically muddy, in fact, after heavy rain. Well, it did not make much difference to Scipio, if this was the kind of bath he had. He went there to wash off sweat, not scent. And what do you think some people will say to this? Well, I don't envy Scipio. If that was the kind of bath he had all the time, it was a real exile's life that he was leading. Yes, and what's more, if you must know, he didn't even have a bath every day. Writers who have left us a record of life in ancient Rome tell us that it was just their arms and legs, which of course they dirtied working, that people washed every day, bathing all over only once a week on market day. Obviously, someone will comment, there must have been times when they were positively disgusting. And what do you think they stank of? I'll tell you, of hard soldiering, of hard work, of all that goes to make up a man. Men are dirtier creatures now than they ever were in the days before the coming of spotlessly clean bathrooms. What is it Horace says when he wants to describe a man noted and indeed notorious for the inordinate length to which he carried personal fastidiousness? Bucillus stinks of scented lozenges. Produce Bucillus today, and he might just as well stink like a goat. He would be in the same position as the Gargonius, with whom Horace contrasted him. for nowadays it is not even enough to use some scented ointment. It must be reapplied 2 or 3 times a day as a precaution against its evaporation on the person. I say nothing about the way people preen themselves on the perfume it carries, as if it were their own. If all this strikes you as being excessively disapproving, you must put it down to the house's atmosphere. During my stay in it, I've learnt from Aegialis, who is the present owner of the estate, and gives a great deal of attention to its management, that trees can be transplanted, even when quite old, a lesson that we old men need to learn when we reckon that every one of us who puts down a new olive plantation is doing so for someone else's benefit, now that I've seen him carefully transplanting one of a number of trees that had given fruit unstintingly over 3 and even 4 seasons. So you too can enjoy the shade of the tree which is slow in coming up, is there to give your grandson shade in later years, long hence, according to our Virgil, who was not concerned with the facts, but with poetic effect, his object being the pleasure of the reader, not the instruction of the farmer. To pick out only one example, let me quote the following passage, which I felt compelled to find fault with today. In spring's the time for sowing beans, then too the crumbling furrows. Clover, welcome you, and millet, too, receives her yearly care. I leave you to conclude from this whether the crops mentioned are to be planted at the same time as each other, and whether in each case they're to be sown in spring. As I write, it's June, getting on for July now, too, and I've seen people harvesting beans and sowing millet on the same day. To get back to our olive plantation, I saw 2 different methods of planting used here. In the first, taking sizable trees and lopping off the branches, cutting them back to 1 foot from the stem, Aegialis transplanted them complete with crown, pruning away the roots and leaving only the actual base, the part to which the roots are attached. This he placed in the hole with an application of manure, and not only earthed it in, but trod and stamped the soil down hard. He says that nothing gives such good results as this packing them down, as he calls it. What it does, of course, is to keep out cold and wind, and apart from that, the tree is less liable to be shifted, thus allowing the young roots to sprout and get a grip on the soil, when they are inevitably tender, and torn from their precarious holds by the slightest disturbance. He also scrapes the crown of the tree before covering it up, because, he says, new roots emerge wherever the wood underneath has been laid bare. The tree, again, should not stand higher than 3 or 4 feet above the ground. This will ensure, right from the start, green growth from the bottom upwards, instead of a large area.